The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, the new F word, was recorded at the National Theatre, London, in December 2015. Here's the chair, broadcaster Jane Garvey.
Hi there. Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate it. My name's Jane Garvey. I'm one of the presenters on Woman's Hour on Radio 4. Does anybody in the room listen to ever engage with Woman's Hour? Can we have a... Yes, thank you. Oh, brilliant. Okay, that makes me feel a bit better about life. Ththank you very much. If there's anybody here who's never listened to Woman's Hour, the exits are quite clearly marked here. You've broken my heart. I can't believe it. It is available 6 days a week now, for Pete's sake. You've got no excuse. And also the podcast and the website. I mean, for God's sake, listen to the bloody thing. Or the BBC will find a reason to take it off, which would just be unbearable. So Woman's Hour isn't perfect, but it's better than nothing. And occasionally, I think it's quite good. And I speak from a position of authority, obviously. But there are many, many ways in which Woman's Hour could improve, and we really do mean it when we say we want the audience to engage with what we do. And if anyone is listening and frankly is frustrated by what's being discussed or by how things are being discussed, let us know and we will try to change things. We won't be able to do it unless you tell us. So the conversation tonight is the F word, feminism. I would argue actually that it's never been more popular or more mainstream, but maybe the panel are going to disagree with me. I very much hope they do, otherwise it could be a bit of a dull evening. Also, we really want you to engage as well, and we will come to you very, very early on, so it isn't just going to be a load of people making pronouncements. I really want everybody in the room to have a fair crack of the whip as well and get stuck in. I think probably you know you're very familiar with the panel, but we will introduce everybody. This is Sophie from the Women's Equality Party. Yay. Yes. Well, I don't know whether I'm allowed to join the Women's Equality Party. I haven't joined yet because I wasn't sure whether or not I could.
Non-partisan.
So. Right, non-partisan.
Yep.
Okay.
We will need non-political political
so
party.
So I won't get the sack
so
if I join.
Can, yes.
Okay, well, the pressure's on then, isn't it?
Yep.
How much is it?
It ranges from £2 to £4 a month.
You need to pay four.
£4 a month.
Or as much as you.
Or as much as I want. Okay, well, moving swiftly on. Keira Cochrane, I think everybody is familiar with Keira. Keira, can you just briefly outline your status?
My status.
Not marital or Facebook. I mean, just your why you're here tonight.
Oh my God. So I work at The Guardian, and I work running the opinion section online. But I was women's editor for a long time, and I spent 4 years kind of writing about women's issues and writing a book called All the Rebel Women, which was about the idea of a fourth wave of feminism.
Okay, yeah. Great. And Julia Hartley Brewer. Now, Julia is our... how can I put this? She's to the right. My left, but you are to the right.
I have no party political allegiance whatsoever, actually. I used to work at The Guardian, interestingly.
What did you do at The Guardian?
I was a news reporter and a political reporter.
Okay.
Interesting days.
Okay. When was that? Who was the Labour leader during that time?
God. I don't know. Attlee. No, Blair.
Tony Blair. Okay. June Ericaduri was actually on Woman's Hour yesterday. Was that right?
Was it
the day before?
I can't remember.
Now, just in case... thank you for that. Obviously, a hugely pivotal moment in your life. how old are you? 17?
Yes.
And you can't remember when you were on Woman's Hour. I was not that cool at your age.
No, like, Woman's Hour is awesome. I just, like, have an interview. So, like, you know, my brain's English, not really Woman's Hour.
Okay.
Sorry. Right,
well,
it was great, though.
But you were on the programme because you object to the idea of feminism being removed from the A-level politics syllabus.
Yeah, so I started that campaign. And, yeah, I think Nicky Morgan might listen, but... Yeah, we've done lots of feminist campaigning with this one. And I write The New Statesman.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And you are still at school?
Yeah. Okay. Last year.
Right, okay. Limco, now I know who you are. You have been my guest editor on Women's Hour, and I don't meet that many people who can talk more than me. You are one of those. You're one of those people.
Sadly so, yes, I am. But I thought it was a really amazing conversation to have, and I quite like my new egg and spouse race conversation. I thought that was a new pinnacle of my career, I think.
Yes.
Having an egg count on the BBC.
Yeah, I know that you get a bit fed up with people saying that you are the anti-FGM campaigner. Nevertheless, I was this morning actually at a Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists conference on FGM. And, you know, sometimes you underestimate the influence that you've had and the amazing stuff that you have done on this. And I know maybe you get fed up because you don't always want to talk about it. But I really hope you appreciate how much good work you've done, and Layla.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. And I think everybody in the room should credit Nimco. I think it's really important that we mention it.
No, I think it's just one of those things that there has been a lot of great work done, but I think it's because, like, you know, amazing women came before me that actually kind of laid the foundations for that. So I'm grateful to them as well, and also for all the support that the Women's Hour and other women have given me on that platform as well.
Thank you. And Abby Morgan. Abby Morgan is the screenwriter and playwright and writer, and Suffragette was your film.
It was definitely my film, yeah.
Right, okay. Has everybody in the room seen Suffragette?
Yes.
Yes, okay. I've got to be honest, Abby, I saw it the first time at a press screening, then I saw it again with my daughters. A whole different experience. Mm. And to watch your ludicrously opinionated, super cool 15-year-old girl drop her popcorn and actually focus on... She wasn't even looking at her phone. Honestly, that's a result.
Oh, that's
and
great.
I know that, I really do think your achievement is absolutely massive, and I hope you're chuffed with yourself.
I don't think quite compares.
I don't think this side got the love.
Sorry.
I don't think we felt the love, to be honest with you.
I don't like the three of you as much as I like the people here. Okay. Well spotted, though. All right, well, in that case, let's start. I think, actually, it's important we do start with Sophie, because Sophie has nailed her feminist colours to her political mast.
Yep.
So, Sophie, tell us where the Women's Equality Party came from. Tell us all about it.
I think it came from a deep frustration that none of the existing then political parties were taking women's rights... experiences seriously, and in fact were treating women as though they were a special interest party, you know, the bit that you get to at the back of the manifesto when you've done all the really serious bits. For me, I came to it through a process of so I was very politicised when I was a child. My parents were Labour. They were both Northern working class Labour activists, and we did a lot of marching. And then I left home and worked as a journalist, and was very, you know, my way of sort of participating was to report and report other people's experiences. And then I had children, and the world tilted, and then I discovered we discovered that my eldest daughter was diagnosed with autism, and the world tilted again, and that was the point where you know, it took us 5 years to get an autism diagnosis for my daughter, and I think a lot of that is to do with the fact that we were working with male templates of autism. Women don't get autism; men get autism. Because, that whole process of sort of trying to be heard and trying to get people to understand her difference and her embrace her diversity, to me, actually became representative of what I had been feeling in what was quite a sort of gauzy, opaque way. And then, you know, we sort of ran into the 2015 election, and I just thought nobody is talking to me about anything that really, really affects my life. Right. And the stuff that I would prioritise seems to be an absolute, not even bottom of the list.
Julia, listening to that, do you honestly believe that there was a gap, that none of the major political parties were truly engaging?
No, this is the first time I'm going to be booed this evening, among many.
Okay.
Well, go I've got it. The utmost respect for you, as we've been discussing backstage.
However, I know what's coming when you say that.
I think A, there wasn't a gap, and B, it has been a horrendously tactically poor error to try and fill that gap. I think that's going to actually hurt the cause of pushing female equality in the political world, in the business world and elsewhere, about by separating women off. My mother, as a working class woman who went to university and was trained to become a GP with two kids as a single mum, she didn't fight the battle she fought that enabled me to have the life I have and the life I hope my 9-year-old will have, for women to be separated off in this way. I just simply don't see...
But they already are separated off.
No, I don't think they are. I think that's not what... I think that's one of the reasons why so many women who actually are very career-minded, very educated, very passionate, and actually, a dinner lady fighting for her higher pay will actually be a feminist but not know it and not use that word, because of this urge that there's been in recent years to separate women off. Most women, in my view, don't view themselves separately from the rest of society in the same way.
Nimco.
No, I was just going to say, can I come in? Sure. I think in terms of having women at the forefront and more women in politics does actually change things, and I think the Women's Equality Party being non-partisan kind of helps. So in terms of even the conversation around FGM, if it wasn't for women in the last coalition government, it would not have gone anywhere. And I think it's that whole thing of actually women understanding. And I also, I give a lot of credit sometimes to Theresa May, but ultimately when it came to the issue of gangs, it was her that actually put a gender lens on the conversation. So I think women within Parliament and within the political sphere do have a different take on things. And it is a personal experience to be a woman on a day-to-day basis, and you do see things differently. I felt like, being a woman and being from an ethnic minority, we were sidelined for a long time in terms of politics. Mm-hmm. And it was always the fact that we will talk to the community, and the community were always men. So I think politics does need a gender lens. And so it's not about separating, it's about putting a gender equality sure. on the platform.
June, your classmates at the school, what do they think of the idea of the Women's Equality Party?
Well, if I'm completely honest, I don't think a lot of them are aware about the Women's Equality Party. And I think actually there are lots of young women who are interested in politics and who want to be involved in politics, but a lot of them see a very male-dominated space. So they just get turned off because they're like, it's not for me. No one's talking about things that are interesting to me. No one's trying to represent me, especially. I think if there's any group that's completely ignored by the government, especially the current government, it's young people. And within that group, it's more and more like young women, and then someone like me, a young black girl, is completely sidelined. Like, no one really cares about things that are interesting to me or things that affect me as a young woman. So I do think actually there needs to be a lot more young women going to politics. The number of young women who've joined the Labour Party since after the election, and the number I've spoken to who've actually thinking about leaving, is actually quite worrying, because they're just being completely turned off by everything that's going on currently in Labour. I don't know if you've heard of Abby Tomlinson, who started the Millie fandom movement. Like, I'm really quite good friends with her, and the number of conversations we've had in the last week where I've had to be like, she's like, I think I might leave, because I just don't think politics is a space where I can be where I want to be, where I can do the things I want, if it's currently just old white men shouting, arguing, and not really listening to me. That puts them off.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Abby, one of many surprising things about suffragette actually was that the film hadn't been made before. Mm. And there had been a TV series about the suffragettes, hadn't there? Though I don't remember it, and I'm ancient. So why? I mean, that in itself tells us that there's a problem here.
Yeah, I mean, I get asked this question quite a lot, and I've just been in the States for the last 3 months, and it's definitely something that, there's been one film made over there about the American suffragette movement, which is very different to ours and very complex and really interesting. I think it's for a number of reasons. I mean, but I think more than anything, we should be robust enough to take a period where we do have a Women's Equality Party for however long that lasts, this dialogue should be about saying, we can take this, we can take, you know, and the men will deal with it. Mm. And so the bigger issue that has, I think, about the suffragette film is, I think it wasn't made for several reasons. I think because we know that women's history has been sidelined. You know, I adapted Birdsong, Sebastian Falk's book, which is a beautiful book, but I suddenly realized I'd looked at the whole of the First World War primarily from the man's perspective. So, of course, you know, you could go throughout history and go, we could reclaim our history. And we know that on the whole, historians were traditionally men. So there is that. There's also about box office. And, you know, we have to prove ourselves in the box office. And so that was what was so important to us with Suffragette, that we could sell in the UK, because we have to be able to say, not only should these films be made, but they can make money. Yeah. And so that's part of the cycle, which is why people say, well, those films just don't make money anymore. And so that was a real, for us, that was one of the most important things for that reason. And then the third thing is, you need to see it to be it. And so, you know, I think if you look around the room, we know that in last year alone, there are only 6.3% of films were directed by women. I think women, of course, are not always going to tell women's stories. You know, we want to be able to do the Marvel comic franchise. We, you know, we want to be able to do the bigger movies. But it is a fact that there are not as many female directors who have been supported. And so those stories have not been as interesting to men in the same way, so they just haven't appeared. And so right. I think it's a sort of combination of all those three things.
I mean, you do get a lot of films about male friendships, the bromances.
Yeah, and you don't get ensemble. You know that's the joy of... I think comedy's been incredible for that. That's what Bridesmaids has done. That's why it's fantastic. It's an ensemble of Ghostbusters because, you know, when you do a movie, one of the things that I find most exciting is that when you see the roll of credit, credits at the end, you go, God, 200 people have got jobs out of this. It's an incredible industry. And if you only ever have one actress playing the wife or occasionally the lead cop, then the secondary actresses never get a chance to prove them their currency. Yeah. And they never get that point where you go, she's really good, let's make her the lead, whereas men have that all the time. So it's about the ensemble.
I quite like your to go back to politics, I'm going to treat you as a non-political person, yeah. I don't know whether you are or not, but where do you stand on the row between Sophie and Julia about the idea of Women's Equality Party
being some
kind of niche.
I don't think it's a niche. I mean, I think
it into a niche.
You know, it's the same with quotas. You know, men have had their quotas, undoubtedly. You know, I go into rooms the whole time and I think there is a quota of men. And so I think it's fine that we have a period where, I mean, you know, what I think about the Women's Equality Party is that I think it's really important because it's creating this conversation. I think the fact that it's taking on 6 clear policies is really great messaging. I think when you talk about the youth, which is one of the most important things, is I think the younger generation are ambivalent because, and so therefore they're not being sold to. There's no business. It's all business. Mm. And so they're not being treated as adults. They're not being saying, what do you need? What do you want? Vote for us and we'll give you that. It's going to the older, you know, the older people are doing it. So I think the fact is that we can, politics can survive it. I look at you and I know you can survive the Women's Equality Party. Because, you know, I have no doubt about it. And the fact is that we need to have very clear messaging on this. And what we're saying is there are 6 really important issues here. Let's talk about them. And there may be a point that we don't always need the Women's Equality Party because it will become part of the mainstream. But for this moment, statistically, we know that there is the magic 17% in America, which is 17% of women in the boardroom, 17% of women in law, 17% of women in all professions, including background artists in film. So we know we've plateaued. Mm. So that very fact, there's a simple correlation to what's going on in the UK, we need to readdress the balance. So from my point of view, we can survive it. Okay. It's great that they're there.
Kira, have you joined the Women's Equality Party?
I haven't, but only because I'm a journalist, so I kind of feel that I should be, you know.
Like myself.
Yes.
Rising
very
above.
I'm very much like you, Jay.
Yeah. Well, aren't you fortunate? Are you glad it exists, or are you a little bit wary?
I am glad it exists. I think to have a party that can really kind of put pressure on the other main parties on specific issues. So you've got these 6 issues. Mm. I think it's really powerful. And I know when I was women's editor, I was constantly, you know, people would constantly say to me, we don't need a women's editor anymore. And I would say, well, you know, look at the news pages, look at the sports pages. To have an area where that is actually dedicated to conversations about women can be really powerful. And I think it's necessary until we get to a situation where there is anything like equal representation. You know, I think it's, 29% of MPs now are women, 25% of the Lords. Mm. We're still, you know, we've moved up. There was a time when, you know, you were talking about the 17%, when in the UK it was very much kind of 22%, like everywhere was 22%. We've moved slightly, but there's still a really long way to go. And I think if we can open up a space to talk about really, really important issues that get discussed far too little, that can only be a good thing.
I really do think, though, that, like, with the Women's Equality Party, like, the one thing that I'd really like to see, not just with the Women's Equality Party, but with all parties, is trying to engage, like, different types of women in politics. Yes. Because I do think you need to have young women, you need to have young black women, so women from ethnic minority groups, you need to have working class women, which I think is a group of women in feminism that people just completely, like, ignore. That people ignore working class women, old women, and older women and their voices are completely ignored within feminism, within politics, no one's really talking about them. Queer women, disabled women, I think all those groups need to be involved in politics, because we can't really kind of like have one sort of like lens of like this one means to be a woman, and that's kind of like the problem that we've tried to be like there's no one way of being a woman, like this is not the woman's issue, like not all women are the same. So I think with the Women's Equality Party, with all parties, there needs to not be this thing where, you know, you can just be like, oh, we'll just get a bus, you know, and just like call it, make it pink, yes. And just, you know, get women's issues.
It wasn't pink, okay, well, it was
whatever, Magneto, whatever it was. Else. But, you know, like, there needs to be a, like, effort from politicians to make sure that you are engaging with all different women from different backgrounds, and it isn't just a very sort of, like, white middle-class approach, because that's what a lot of parties tend to do. They just kind of, I mean, they're working mothers who, you know, are basically not eating because they have to feed their kids. Yeah. That's a feminist issue. Austerity is a feminist issue.
It's not.
Okay, but Julia, I think what's... Just very briefly, we'll get to Julia in a second. Sophie, go on.
I think if I can just come in on some of that stuff in terms of what the Women's Equality Party is trying to do, is what a really important part of our job as we see it is to send the message that equality doesn't belong to one political party, because what we are with the situation we're in at the moment, although we exist, the other political parties see it as something that belongs to them, and that you have to vote for us and then we will give you a bit of it. Yeah. And you'll probably have to wait because it's really hard, but we'll give you a bit. Yeah. But just vote for us. And what we're trying to say is it doesn't work that way. It's not something that belongs to each party. You know, women are 51% of the population. As you say, very rightly point out, that we are a hugely broad and diverse range of people, and you need to be taking that into account, and you need to be offering policies for us.
Yeah, and you're doing quite well to address that, so well done.
And I mean, obviously, the first thing that happened was went out, and it was, oh, the Women's Equality Party is white, middle class. What a disappointment, falling at the first hurdle.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Probably many, many people did. Mm. And it was one of the things that we set to work on immediately. Mm-hmm. We are working really, really hard within all of our branches. We've got more than 70 local branches now. All of our branches are working with outreach to all the local groups in their communities to say that this is a party for people of all backgrounds and all ages. And also, I'd just also like to say that what we haven't mentioned is older women.
Yeah.
There are an awful lot of older women joining our party because they are sick of being invisible.
Yeah, exactly, because older women are invisible in politics and feminism.
Just to go back to the idea of the word feminism, I think it's probably undeniable, not amongst the people in this room tonight, who obviously have decided to come to this conversation for a multitude of reasons, but I think, Julia, you'd acknowledge there is still a sort of toxicity about that word,
yes.
Isn't there?
Yeah, I'm always stunned by how many people wouldn't describe themselves as a feminist. I mean, you know, if you say to someone, you know, are you a racist? Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Are you homophobic? Oh, absolutely not. So you know, and in terms of your attitude to women, you're a feminist. Well, not really. And to me, I you know, it is. It's very simple. Do you think that men and women should be treated equally in the same way that you think that blacks and whites, gays and straight? There's nothing complicated. There's nothing controversial. And any pretty, you know, sensible person should be a feminist and should be proud. I'm proud of not being a racist. Should be the same as I'm proud of being a feminist. It is absurd that so many women and men are afraid of that word. I've certainly, I consider myself a card-carrying feminist with a capital F, you know.
Right, so why are some people still wary of it? And you do still get those actually often heartbreakingly successful women who will say in public, in interviews, I'm not a feminist.
It was very successfully rebranded. So I think what happened was we had some really fantastically important pieces of legislation in the 1970s. We had the Equal Pay Act, we had the Sex Discrimination Act, and everybody thought that things were fixed. And so everybody sat back a bit, I think, and thought, okay, well, we can let the law take its course. We've done this. It's going to be brilliant. At the same time, the anti-feminists did a very good job of starting to rebrand feminists as being man-hating lunatics. Around about the same time, all the I would have to say, the men in business and politics roundly failed to lean in. So none of that legislation worked as well as it should have. People like Alan Sugar went just said, well, if I can't ask women if they're going to have children, I'm just not going to employ any. And so that was the 80s. And then in the 90s, we went into this thing where the best way that women could be powerful was to wield their sexuality really aggressively. And so, you know, women were signing up for pole dancing classes and a work night out was going to a strip club, and again anybody protesting this was seen as feminist, crazy, probably had lots of cats,
never forget fat and ugly, always.
And then what happened, and I find actually I think that feminism is having a fantastic relaunch, if you like, because I think what happened in 2000s and subsequently was that we had the three last straws. We had the corporate rebranding of Pink and Blue, which started going crazy, mm-hmm. and started shutting down boys and girls options. You can only do this, and you can only do this. And then the other thing that happened was that we got social media. And then the financial crisis happened, and suddenly the people who were being really, really hit most by the financial crisis were the poorest people, and the poorest people were women. And so that unpeeled everything and really showed us again how flawed all these structures are. And I think that that has prompted a lot of people to reclaim feminism. A lot of fantastic young women, particularly, have said, "You know what? I'm sick of being characterised this way. I'm going to be a feminist." And I find it hugely heartening. And I think it's actually a lot less toxic than we think.
Okay. Well, and June, you'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I'd agree that, like, especially with the internet, like, a lot of my friends that are, like, feminists, like, some of them are in the audience. Hi, guys. Yeah, we kind of met on the internet. So, like, with things like the Twitter Youth Feminist Army or, like, Powered by Girl and, like, lots of, like, different groups, we, like, met on the internet and we were, like, we're just really, like, fed up with, like, no one really listening to us and, like, boys thinking it's okay to, like, put page 3 in front of us at school and, like, old men, like, harassing us in our school uniform and stuff like that. And we're, like, we're going to call ourselves feminists. And I think it's important for women to feel that they can claim that word and not feel like, oh, being a feminist means, like, you burn your bra, which is Caitlin Moran says, ridiculous. Why would I burn my bra? Like, I love my bra, sorry. But I also think there is a thing where it's not about what you call yourself. And I really firmly do believe in that. Like, if you are actively trying to work on equality, like, call yourself what you want. If you, like, call yourself a feminist but are, like, not doing anything feminist at all, then that label is useless. You know, it's your actions that matter. And obviously, yes, we want to see more women claim the word feminist and going out and not being scared to say that, but, like, it doesn't really bother me. As long as, like, we're having a world where women are coming together and men are supporting them and we're working towards, like, issues to do with women.
Can I just say that, just top tip on how to deal with page 3, because I used to work as a political reporter for the Evening Standard and I sat back to back with the political editor of the Sun. And so every morning I would open the Sun and I would look at page 3 and I would take it to his desk and say, "Oh, I don't like her nipples. I prefer pink. Do you prefer pink nipples or brown? They look a bit small. I don't like what she's wearing. Do you like what she's wearing? I don't. What do you think?" And I would insist on discussing the woman on page 3's tits and arse for 10 minutes, and it drove him up the bloody wall. And I did it every day for 2 years.
So have you effectively ended?
It's in your paper. Be proud of it. You know. So, but that's it. I always think, again, you know, don't ever shy away. Discuss it with them. You'd be amazed how much they're bothered about discuss. They like to look at them, but not discuss the details.
and certainly not with you, I would imagine.
Not with me.
No. Okay. Nimco, have you felt welcomed by feminism? Have you sort of felt, you know, held to the bosom of feminism when you started your campaign?
To the bosoms from page 3.
Joined up thinking.
Yes, actually, I have. And I had this really interesting conversation, and there is a lot of conversation around diversity within the feminist sphere and so on.
Or lack of it.
I think there is diversity, but it's the platforms. And also, I had this conversation with somebody recently about the fact that are there too many white women in the feminist movement. And I'm like, but we live in a country where the majority of the population is white, so obviously they are going to be at the forefront, but it's how they use their platforms in order to have conversations that don't necessarily directly affect them. I could talk about FGM to women that are affected by FGM or communities that are affected by FGM on a day-to-day basis, but they don't necessarily hold the power, and they're not necessarily going to be the ones that are able to change that kind of conversation. I found that there has been a lot of sisterhood and a lot of solidarity, and what I've also found is that there's a lot of amazing women who are held back about saying things because they think they're going to be critiqued and they're going to be criticised. And I think this is one of the things that's really interesting about the Women's Equality Party. We are easy to critique and criticise rather than congratulate. And I think that's what we don't do enough within the movement, is to congratulate a lot of women that have done amazing things. And my kind of mentor always said that with a lot of humility comes a lot of strength. And I think we are humble, but we're also a lot scared. And there was there's a woman that I love and I respect, and she's an amazing newscaster, but she can't talk about certain issues because she's going to be called Islamophobic. It's a fact that I could bang on about issues of polygamy and abuse within certain communities, that's fine, but I need sisters that are not from those communities to have those conversations. So if we're silencing women that have platforms because they're white, I think that's really unhelpful to the wider movement.
I don't think the problem is that there are white women speaking up about these issues. What I do think the problem is, though, is that especially looking at younger women that are like not, that don't have come from this sort of middle class background, a lot of them don't feel like it's something that they can get involved in. I don't have a problem, like, actually, you're right, because working with you on FGM and issues to do with that, there have been tons of like white women who've helped us and given us those platforms and got us on like to talk about different things. What I do think needs to happen is that for any sort of movement to be successful, I don't think that we need to sideline any sort of like women. I think especially now with like the internet, there is that space for different women to come up with their space for different voices and different opinions. And I myself have written in the New Statesman about how I think it's really quite like silly and within feminism for people to just be like, oh, it's just like stupid middle class white women, it's all their fault. Because I don't think it is their fault. I just think as a movement, we have to learn to work together. We're not going to achieve anything, nothing, if we're going to like separate ourselves. We're white women, we do this, you know, black women, we're here.
But also, we need to everybody, people from different backgrounds, different age groups, different social classes, different jobs, different areas, you know, regions, to have the same view. And that's one of the issues I often have, is that you must accept this viewpoint or you are not fitting into
it. No, I don't think anyone's saying church. That, because the whole thing with feminism is that it's for everyone and anyone to be able to get involved. What I don't want is the movement to become so like fragmented that we can't actually achieve anything. I do believe in things like solidarity and sisterhood. I do think women of different races, backgrounds, we do need to come together to address issues together as a movement. And that's one of the things I'm scared of in feminism, is that there are so many like groups being created and cut off because women are angry. And actually, what we're all rubbish at doing, and what we don't want to say, is we're all really bad at listening to each other. We don't want to listen to each other. It's I'm right, you're wrong, and we're not going to achieve anything unless different women come together and look.
Well, I think, but there are women that come together. So, for example, when Lucy was doing the normal page 3, and one of the key conversations that she used to get was the fact that, why are you talking about page 3 and you're not talking about FGM? And it's one of those things. I'm like, we all got each other's back. So if the fact that she's doing that, I'm doing this. And one of the key things, and one of the key roles, why I never did any work with the Sun, even though it's got some amazing writers, it's got some fucked up editors too, is the fact that I said that if you are legitimizing and objectifying women on a day-to-day basis with page 3, then you are legitimizing the abuse that they're receiving. Yeah. So I'm not going to talk about an issue of violence against women and girls, which FGM was, while you have a woman naked on one of the key pages on your paper. So Lucy and I worked together when Caroline was talking about keeping women on the banknotes. Yeah. I had her back, she had my back. Yeah, so I think there is that whole kind of thing of the fact that we don't talk about how much solidarity there was and how much work that kind of was working together. So
I think the key thing you're saying is that it's working, it's practical stuff, it's really pragmatic actions.
Yeah,
and I think that's why this is why women are working really well together, actually. I think right now, from what we're seeing, is that actually what we're doing at the Women's Equality Party and what we're seeing happening a lot elsewhere is that women are saying, you know what, we've spent an awful lot of time talking about what feminism is, and we've spent an awful lot of time worrying about what that looks like. And actually, we've missed out really on getting stuff done. Yeah. And so a lot of what we're doing now is really practical. How do we change this? What does our experience tell us works? How do we do it? Let's just do it.
Yeah, and also that whole thing of, like, if you're working on, like, page 3, you should be working on FGM because that's more important. That's complete nonsense. You know, like, I always find it really interesting how, like, if you, like, start a campaign on something really small, they're like, but what about FGM? It's like, well, you know, like, yes, FGM, it exists, and there are people fighting that. I mean, do you care about FGM? Like, you only bring up FGM when I start working on, like, something to, like, representing women, you know? And it's that. It's like everything comes together that, you know, like, Catherine Moran calls it patchwork quilt of feminism. It's every little feminist act, you know, it comes together, and that contributes to the wider movement. So whether or not it's a teenage girl who's fighting the fact that, you know, her school has a sexist dress code, or it's not with me with my campaign on getting women on the syllabus, whether it's NIMCO and working on FGM, whether it's Abby on, like, getting women into film, all of that is important. There's not one feminist act. Everything is important, and as a movement, we do need to come together with that.
I mean, I think it's really interesting, actually. I was thinking, yes, definitely. I was about to do that really patronising thing of going, my God, you're 17. I mean, like, amazing, amazing. I think this conversation we're having is, I think that, because I agree exactly, I know that when we, you know, the suffragette movement, you know, has been a global movement, and I know that they have been criticised, and as making a film, we have certainly been criticised for not, you know, covering every element or every woman who was in the suffragette movement. And I think, as hard as that is, because, you know, I've discovered Twitter, which is lethal, what I've come away feeling is that I think just acknowledging is the most important thing, because I think you feel a sense of psychic relief. And one of the things I was thinking about with the Women's Equality Party is that I definitely think, psychologically, I think, whew, okay, great. So I think a lot of these things are about saying we are not frightened of the conversation, and it's about calibrating to say there's intersectionality in feminism. We've got to talk about what does it mean to be a disabled feminist? What does it mean to be a black feminist? What does it mean to be a gay feminist? It's very there are differences. We may be united in the fact that we are all trying to strive for equality for all, but there are differences here. And, you know, one of my big beliefs is that we will never have equality. We will only ever have discourse. Because I fundamentally think that we will always try and pull it back and pull it forward and pull it back. And so I think the discourse is all about, it's the grey. Most of life is the grey. We will never get to a plateau where we go, great, 50-50, we're fine now, because it will get pulled.
But I don't understand why everyone is so fixated on the 50-50. I would love to know how many of you are concerned about the incredible, shocking underrepresentation of men in primary school teaching. Is that a big issue for you?
It's on our policy document. This,
there we go.
I would argue that right now is a bigger issue socially in our country than the issue of number of women in the cabinet. That is my personal view.
I think they're intertwined. So, I think they're completely
intertwined.
I think
they're very intertwined.
You've got to get the men to lean in. Where feminism works when men lean in and women embrace men.
Yeah, but likewise,
so
but
to
again,
speak.
But that's what I'm saying. But that's where my feminism doesn't necessarily see it as a battle, or that there is this aim of 50-50. It may well be the case. There may well be the case that equality, which for me, I don't want to call it, I want equality of opportunity, which means that I can be an engineer if I want to be, but if I don't want to be, I don't have to be. Maybe 50% of engineers will never be women, because 50% of people who want to be engineers are not women. Maybe 50% of nurses will never be men, because 50% of people who want to be nurses aren't men. We may have to accept, as part of being a feminist, that women are making choices they want to make, and girls are making choices. I accept that society puts ideas onto them. When I went to Early Learning Centre and discovered that they actually sell globes for girls where the sea is pink, I lost the will to live. But I think we have to accept that there may be... I mean, it's difficult to know which is nature and which is nurture.
I don't think
equality means 50-50.
Thank you. Just a brief mention. I don't know what the panel think of the old... I mean, certainly something that Women's House discussed relatively recently. The old idea that women, if they work, if they have children, also have another job. The old two jobs thing where... I do go to work, but I walk through the door, and actually even before I go to work, I've probably put a load of washing on, maybe done some ironing, maybe made a packed lunch.
I think they should have married better husbands.
Well, maybe they're not married.
No.
So anybody think any real improvement?
Institutionalised.
What is?
My marriage isn't in. My husband will do his bloody half, or he'll bloody be out the door.
So
I. You can you're do the same.
But you're in. But actually, I mean, you're in a position.
Yeah.
But every woman who chooses to do everything at home and then moan about it has made that choice.
Stop making that choice.
Don't do the bloody ironing. Don't do the laundry. Don't do the shopping. Don't do it. It'll get done by him eventually.
The reason there aren't many teaching is, many private teaching is because there's too much work and too little pay.
Yeah. Okay.
I think the word choice is a very loaded one, and so it happens in a vacuum. I think there are things that are happening that are feeding into the so-called choices and the loaded word in terms of that kind of context. And in the education thing, it's something that I'm really concerned about. It's really interesting how many the lack of male primary school teachers, but the amount of head teachers who are men. So I think that's a different kind of conversation. So choice. It's not really choice. I think the balance is set against
Gina Davis. Can I just say this one? Gina Davis has just done an incredible study on gender in the media and equality in the media. And one of the things that they have found, and it's been a very extensive study, and I implore you all to download the study because it's absolutely fascinating. And she talked about representation of roles on television and film. Mm-hmm. And they have found in the US a direct correlation between the uptake of courses with those roles of representation on screen, so that women are taking up absolute correlation of law to how many of lawyers we see on screen played by women. And one of the big things they found is there's a 75% uptake on forensic psychology in women, because this seems to be the role that all women get on screen, and CSI is one of the big things. It's see it to be it. So to answer your point, you know what, let's try it for a while. Let's try 50-50 for a while. They've done it in Sweden in the film industry. They thought they wouldn't do it. They've given 50-50 funding, and
it's patronising.
But we've been patronised for so long.
Doesn't matter. Two wrongs don't make a right. I genuinely think it's so unbelievably patronising.
Give me the answer. I'm sure there's more spirited opinion in the audience. Let anybody else want to have a shout out? Yes, sir.
I am a member, by the way. The word choice has just recently been mentioned. As soon as you have choice, the next word is usually competition. One choice, that choice, that choice.
So
in the realms of competition, you're in the realms of men. Men are better at competition, mainly because they're too stupid to know that cooperation is better. My dream, and cooperation could work if people withdraw, to make people realise how important they are, especially women.
Right.
So if all of the political parties, the women represented, can all be persuaded to withdraw their support for their party on the same day and all join the women.
Yeah.
But I am suggesting that a subtitle for ever using the word equality is always equal but different. Because as soon as you use equal by itself, you're in the realms of competition. But women are not as good as that as men.
To get back to my point about household chores, how much do you do in the home?
Sorry?
How much do you do in the home? Yeah, no, never mind. I want to know what you're doing.
Cook?
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Can I make a point on women and housework?
Okay, thank you.
I think that childcare and the cost of it and women's work is one of the things that we still haven't won with feminism. Just like reproductive rights, is one of those issues that we're still fighting for. I can't believe that in 2015, issues to do with childcare and women's work and all those things
is women's work?
Women are left with.
Yeah, well, women, that's what I mean.
I'm fascinated. What is women's work? My mum's a GP. Okay. Being a doctor is women's work.
It's the work that women basically have to do, and they're not, unpaid work that women do. That is a problem for a lot of women. And I think, actually, Helen Lewis from The New Statesman, who's a brilliant writer, wrote something called The Motherhood Trap. And obviously she got a lot of, people kind of reacted on Twitter about it. But what she was actually arguing was about how a lot of women, working class women, I'm really sorry, but it's a thing. If you have children and you don't have support, you can get held back.
That's a fact. And actually, until our country makes sure that childcare is free and available for all women, if you have a child and you have a husband, and someone's going to have to take that, you know, that the brunt of that. And very often it's women.
They
so very
to
often,
do it.
No, I don't think
kids.
I really don't think that they choose to do it. Okay.
Do you know what? Can I say, speaking on behalf of many professional women?
Can I finish my point, please? Can I finish my point? Because actually, I feel like finished. I think I look at my mother and I look at the fact that she is actually able to go to work, but the only reason she was able to do that was because she had a support system of her really younger sisters who were able to do the childcare to stay at home while she started her business and ran that. If women don't have that, if they don't have that support system, they're not choosing to stay at home. Some women do choose. Yes, some women make the choice to stay at home and take care of their children. But a lot of women don't have that choice. And that is something that we need to address.
Let Julia just ask that question, and I will come to that. Very briefly, yeah.
Really briefly, I am so fed up, with all due respect, of young women without children telling me how women are being forced to stay at home with their children. Most women, and poll after poll, would rather work part-time than full-time because they'd like to be with their kids. It's a choice that women are making in the 21st century that they are freely making. Some women make different choices. Some women want to go out to work and don't want to be with their kids. That's their choice. Some want to just be with their kids all the time or something in between.
I mean, Julie,
and the idea that in any way this is being forced on women is absurd.
I want to bring the audience in. There's lots of hands up. So can I just go over to the hand up over there? Thank you.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, the idea of choice fails here because we live in a systemically sexist world. So we're all brought up with internalized misogyny, socialization as the gender binary and what we associate with genders means that even if you feel like you're making an explicit choice, you might be, but there are many factors that you cannot control that lead into you making that choice.
Yeah, I mean, okay, that's a fair point. How much of a choice is this, really, Julia?
Choice. In the same way that, what are the choices that men have? How many men feel they've got the choice to be at home and be a stay-at-home dad? How many choices do men have to be single dads and have the kids in a breakup almost without fail, unless the mum's an alcoholic or a drug addict or violent? The dads don't get the kids. The choices work.
So where are all the men campaigning for equal pay?
Okay.
Where are all the men campaigning for equal parenting?
There are plenty of men.
Apart from the people who are joining the Women's Equality Party, that is, and there's plenty of them. There is a systemic problem here that we keep saying all these poor men and this, that, and the other. I'd like to hear. We're hearing from many of those men, but there needs to be more. The men need to lean in. I've looked something up. I did the Being a Man festival at the South Bank, and I found this fantastic study, which I talked about then. I like to talk about really, really briefly now. But this is a Nordic study, which picked up the idea it was looking at gender equality and whether closing the disparities and inequality is good not just for men, not just for women, but for men too. And it found that if you live in one of the more gender-equal countries in Europe, you are twice as likely to have a higher quality of life. If you live in a gender-equal country, you are likely to have a higher level of overall well-being, lower rates of depression and divorce, and a reduced likelihood of suffering violent death. It also found, and this is what is really interesting, it found a clear connection between a country's level of gender equality and men's participation in unpaid care work, such as childcare, housework, and care of elderly parents. And it also found the reason most men are not more supportive of gender equality campaigns is that they are not aware that gender equality will increase their quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. Abby, I know you wanted to say something.
No, it's fine, actually.
Has the moment passed?
It's fine.
Okay,
yeah.
There were lots of hands up, so can we have the microphone there? Thank you. The microphone's coming, yeah.
I agree with what you were just saying about how, you know, it is still a choice and there aren't enough men looking after children and stuff. But I think the problem with our society currently is that we still put so much weight on economic activity, on earning, and so much of our sense of what is valuable is placed on the economic role, such that men don't feel like helping in the home or becoming parents and being parent like men that are the person that's at home with the children is a particularly valuable role because we still value the economic role. And it's still women that are considered the ones that are going to fill in those gaps.
Exactly.
We put no economic value on the...
I think also there are a lot of women who feel that way. But I have to say, I mean, the men in my circle, they judge themselves. One of their key factors in how they judge themselves and their friends is how good a father they are.
I wouldn't say that's consistent with my experience of my parents, and I wouldn't say it's consistent with my experience of my peer group either. As a young woman that's going into law school at the moment with my friend, I don't feel like that's the position that we're put in. I don't feel like that's the value that we're presented with. Yeah. You know, we're not put in a pool with like boys equally, both of us thinking like, oh, we could go into this and like one of us could come out of it and be the parent. We're put in thinking like we should be really going for this economic thing. That's like where we're going to get our sense of value.
The reality is, for both men and women, if you want to be a truly involved parent, you're probably going to have to take a back seat on your career for a few years to be available and around for your child in the early years, if that's what you choose to do. And that's the case for men and women. I think we are ignoring the fact that for many men, they've got a wife and kids and they're directors of companies, whereas there are very few women who are FTSE 100 directors who have a husband and kids. But the reality is, actually, those men don't have a family life. They don't see their kids. They leave in the morning at 5 or 6 in the morning. They get back at 9 p.m. They see their kids on a Saturday, maybe. Then they go back to work in the office.
So why are they not campaigning to spend more time with their children?
That's up to them.
No, but why are we talking about, why is the focus on men here? Like, yes, okay.
Because it's the other side of the coin.
That matters. You know, yeah, talk about men. But I'm really sorry, when women are the ones doing most of the care work at home, when women are the ones doing most jobs to do with nursing, to do with caring, they're the ones getting, most women are on the carer's allowance, most women are the ones caring for the elderly. Okay, I'm really sorry, but that is something that we should be focusing on. We shouldn't be saying that's a choice, that all women are just choosing to do those careers, because those are the lower paid jobs. I'm really sorry, but austerity is an issue that will directly affect women. When you make cuts to domestic violence services, that will affect women, because the people that are most directly affected by issues to do with domestic violence are women. This is my biggest problem with feminism, that lots of feminists want to go, oh, but what about the men? Yes, there are men, and yes, they are being affected by equality, but that doesn't mean that we can't talk about women, because I don't want a conversation where women are completely sidelined, and that's the problem. But we don't want to talk about women's issues. They matter, okay? Like, those issues matter.
Can we just have a few more questions?
In 2015, yep. Are we doing this at all still?
Yes, okay, that was more of an observation. Can we just have the microphone there where the hands are up, please? Fourth row. Yeah, thank you. Right, here we go.
Can we just share the mic for a little bit?
Sorry,
is that right?
We just both had a point.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just wanted to make a comment on, you were speaking about people having the choice to do like certain things earlier. And I think it's very dangerous, not just in feminism, but there's this assumption across politics and stuff, and it's the assumption that people do have a choice in these instances. And I think in feminism, in, you know, conversations about benefits and all that sort of thing, it's the idea that people do have a choice to do things, and I think it's very dangerous, and it creates a very dangerous narrative, assuming that people can choose to act in certain ways and do certain things, and I think it's just wrong. I think it's very dangerous to do that.
You think that women have no choice about whether they do housework or look after the kids?
Have no choice, but I think the assumption that all women have a choice, that's different thing.
Women have more or less choice depending on their opportunities outside the home.
I don't think that's true. I don't think everybody does have a choice. Now, that's why I'm saying it's very dangerous to assume that sort of it's a universal thing. People do have a choice, because people find themselves in situations where they literally do not have a choice, and the argument you're making is predicated on the notion that they do, and I think that's very dangerous.
A woman in a domestic violence situation, battered for years, I don't believe has a choice. No, that free choice has been taken away from her. For women who are not in violent relationships, yes, they all still have a choice of lesser or more, depending on their economic ability to earn.
I think it's the choice of, you can have any car you want, but they only come in grey, and then you think you've chosen grey, so I don't think. I think what she's talking about, the choice, is that it's quite relative.
I understand it's relative, but
there was another point.
Yeah, the microphone.
Yeah, I was just following on from that. What's happening here is like, which is what I keep getting really pissed off on social media. If I make a point about feminism and I'm trying to get my voice out there, people are constantly undermining feminism, because I think they're viewing it from this generalised view of stuff we're talking about. Feminism is so much bigger than... I'm not devaluing the points we're talking about here. Feminism is so much bigger than us talking about what you were discussing earlier, like white middle class discussions, which are still important, but there's a whole world out there of women who are systematically oppressed, and not just women, men as well, in other countries. It's bigger than us. It's bigger than this. I'm getting really annoyed by people generalising feminism, and that's where we're getting stunted. We're still, like Abby was saying, it's this discourse which is holding us back. Where if we all just unite together, like, you've just got to think with feminism, you're fighting not just on behalf of yourself and your comfort zone, you're fighting for people across the world that aren't being given a platform and aren't having a voice. So when you're sitting there saying all women have a choice, like, I respect your opinion, but
I'm not talking about women in Saudi Arabia. I'm talking about women here.
But we should.
But you're saying we need to unite, but only if we unite around your point of view.
No, but you shouldn't have to. You shouldn't have to do this oppression Olympics. Oh,
no, that's what it is.
Woman. No, no,
that's what it is.
No, you shouldn't have to go. Really, oh, women in Saudi Arabia doesn't have a choice, and women in England have. You know, I'm sorry, but I have friends who are currently. I have a young friend who's a girl in my year who's gone off to do wants to do engineering, and she went to Imperial College London for an interview, and she came back and she said there were 35 boys and 3 girls. I really don't think that, you know, when you have instances like that, that, you know, all the girls are choosing not to go into sciences and STEM and engineering. I think there are actual things that are holding them back. When 50% of the people who do A-levels in politics and maths are boys, I really don't think, like, more than 50, like, I can't remember what the statistic, but, like, it's, there's really, really, like, high numbers of boys doing A-level physics and maths. So someone in the room who does, like, STEM subjects, who's helped me with that. But, like, the number of girls doing it, it's systematic, it drops. It really does drop.
Can I come back on this tweet?
I just want Abby. You can insert. Sorry, I've just done. I know the one you mean. You can. Yeah. Go on, Abby.
I think. Really, you know all my friends, do you? No. Funnily enough, you don't. Yeah.
Well, you know what? Actually, I kind of. I love, you know, I don't think you appreciate just how useful you are on a panel like this. I hope you realise it, because you're so,
good booking.
I mean, you know, you're playing a role really well here. And I think fundamentally, you know, having had a drink with you, and I'm not trying to, you know, I think you're smart. I think you believe in equality. I think all our views aren't dissimilar, actually. But I think what we're talking about fundamentally is that, and it goes back to what you said, which is basically equality for women. It's a two-gender conversation. If we are equal, we all know feminist men. We all know that the society works better. But as a very small anecdote, which is I just wrote a show which was about a cop breaking down. And I sat in a Q&A with a police officer, and I always get the question saying, why do you always write such strong women?
Oh.
And I'm always like, no, I write women. But for the first time ever, they said to this man who was the lead, what was it like to play such a fragile man? And he said, it was such a relief. I'm so tired of playing the hero. Why can't I ever break down? I always watch the movies, and it's women that can break down. And I think this is the same thing. All we're saying is that, can we look at the complexity of our roles and recalibrate?
And I'd like to pick up on that.
Carry on, because that was it.
So I was doing a debate. I think that's a wonderful point. I was doing a BBC 100 Women thing, debate, and it was about, and it ended up being very much a discussion about women in the workplace and corporate identity in a way that was a little odd, and that sort of strong female thing kept coming up, and there were women there saying, you've got to be, you know, you've got to get a thicker skin. And you've got to be a strong female role. And I find it very disheartening that the way the conversation goes, that men have got to be seen to be more fragile. And like there's a sort of, it's like the yin and yang, that women have therefore got to be seen to be more stronger. And I think what we need to be able to do is to be able to just show women as they are in all their diversity. And that being a strong female role, which is awful, it's just actually a female role. And there are many, many, many different kinds of female roles. And I think a lot of what we're doing here is we keep trying to sort of, there's this shorthand that we fall into, that women must do this and men must do this. And actually, we've just got to embrace, I think it's about finding space to allow people to be.
Yeah, and also I think we have to be very conscious of our unconscious bias, because we know we live in a diverse society. Yes. We know we live in a multicultural society. You know, you say, I'm not talking about Saudi Arabia. Well, you know, many of the, as you know, we are multicultural now. So many of those views are over here as well. So, you know, what we're talking, you know, when you said that, you know, there's a roll call at the end of Suffragette, and it says 2015, Saudi Arabia will get the municipal vote. And everyone goes, God, that's amazing, that's so great. I was on CNN, and a fantastic lawyer, high-ranking lawyer, female lawyer in Saudi Arabia. I said, isn't it great? You're going to get the vote. She said, yes, but my... the man of the house will have to drive me there. And in my case, as a divorcee, that's my 10-year-old son, and he can't drive, so I don't know how I'm going to get there. And second, as the 10-year-old and the man of the house, he will decide my vote. And so the point is that does travel. You know, it's easy, and we have to keep remembering that, yes, we are having this conversation. Yes, these policies are being made for the, you know, we're talking about policies for the UK, but they're global as well, and they're about the global conversation.
Right. Well, on that point, then, I'm glad somebody mentioned Saudi Arabia, but, I mean, where does the Women's Equality Party stand on Britain's, shall we say, complicated relationship with Saudi Arabia?
So the Women's Equality Party has got six key goals, which are based around achieving...
Okay, let's cut to the chase. The
point is, beyond that, any candidate standing for the Women's Equality Party has got a free vote. So... If you remember, you sign up to.
Where do you stand?
That's my answer. I mean, I wrote a piece in the New Statesman this week about my version of what my feminist foreign policy would be.
Okay.
And it's a very and it's a personal view.
Would we stop selling arms to Saudi Arabia?
My personal belief is that I think we should be showing solidarity with the women in Saudi Arabia. Yeah.
Let's face it, when black people were being treated as unequal in South Africa, we had a certain policy. When women are being treated unequally in another country, we go, it's a cultural difference. And I think if you take the word women and you insert the word black, if you're not happy with it, then you should act accordingly.
Well, I think
it's not just Saudi Arabia, it's America has some shitty policy on women as well, so does the UK, Eastern countries.
And I also think it's really important that different countries are allowed to lead their own sort of like feminist movements. Yes, it's a united feminist movement, and yes, there's solidarity around it, but I have no right to tell a woman in Nigeria how she should react to things that are affecting her as a woman there and be like, oh, I'm coming from the UK, you know, this or... No. It's about uniting that global, like Abby said, it's a global feminist movement. It's about coming together, but recognizing that women in different countries do have it worse than we do. That doesn't then mean that what we have is okay. That doesn't then mean that, oh, because we've reached like a 29%, you know, in Parliament, and because in other countries they have like no women in parliament, it's all right, you know, shut up. No, it doesn't mean that. It means that actually we join our hands and we work together in solidarity to make sure that, you know, across the world, gender equality is one of the issues that we're talking about. And that's what I really want to see in feminists, a global feminist sisterhood. Not sort of me going over to your country and telling you what to do, but actually recognizing that there are different levels of inequality around the world and we do have to fight them in different ways that we can. And it's not about the fact that a woman in Saudi Arabia has a vote and I do have a vote here. It's not about I do have a vote here, like you, but that doesn't mean that because, oh, we can just make those comparisons. Oh, you know, well, women in Saudi Arabia have it worse. Women in the UK, you know, there are two women in the UK get killed every single week by a man, okay? That doesn't mean that UK is an equal society.
No, I don't think anyone's pretending that Britain's perfect in any shape or form. Any other questions from the audience? I think you can probably shout from there. Or the microphone. Where is the microphone? Oh, it's coming. Sorry.
I can be fairly loud.
Yeah. Go on then. You be loud. Yeah. Okay, great.
So there's one thing that I want to, I guess, I'll ask for your opinion about. Because I found myself in an interesting conversation just last week, fairly topical, in a corporate setting where I was, unfortunately, the only woman raising the issue that we really lack a lot of middle managers who are female, so we have quite a lot of, you know, think of it as a pyramid in an organization. We have quite a lot of female at the bottom and quite a few at the top, but nothing in between.
What kind of business is it?
It's a private company. So
making something or?
Say again?
What do you make?
No, it's an internet company.
Internet.
So allow me not to give any more details about that.
All right.
If you don't mind. And the very interesting thing is, and I am personally very exhausted about fighting this kind of commentary, because I suggested that maybe there should be some sort of mentoring scheme for women who've made it to the top to mentor the ones who are at the very bottom so the middle can also be representative. And it was like, well, go get a male mentor because it doesn't have to be... I mean, this is like someone who actually says this is a female as well. So there is this inherent competition that if you actually side with the strong side and if you don't necessarily always side with the radical feminist ideas, you tend to get ahead a lot faster than people like me who would actually raise that issue.
Right.
So I find that very disturbing. I think the discourse needs a bit more hope. where do we go from here? Rather than all this bickering about, oh, but like, you know, we have this great equality thing, and then you can just get a male mentor who can really give me no credible ideas because they don't really suffer from the same glass ceiling as I do. So what sort of experience can they share with me, or how can they mentor me against something they don't really experience?
All right, thank you. Kira, I mean, what about mentoring? And I don't know, whether have you had any mentors, male, female?
I have not had any mentors.
Have you ever asked for one or wanted one?
No, I have had mentors, yeah. Casually, sort of unofficially. I think it's great to kind of set up mentoring organisation. You know, I think it's something that women should be doing. I think also I just wanted to talk about feminism more generally, and it's just been so good kind of hearing June talk, because I know June's set up a campaign recently, and when I was interviewing women about this kind of idea of a fourth wave, what was really exciting about it was that it wasn't just a discursive movement, it was a really sort of creative movement. So it was often women who hadn't even thought about what they were doing as feminism, just getting up and making things. And that's what I feel is exciting at the moment, you know, and that's what I really want to kind of concentrate on and want to see more of. So, mentoring schemes would be great, but, you know, June's campaign to get politics on the A-level syllabus, fantastic. You know, Abby writing Suffragette, like, you know, that's when feminism is at its absolute best, you know, and you saw it with the suffragettes.
As our contributor suggested, sometimes it's easier to get on by playing the game and not attaching yourself.
Yeah, I mean, there's a brilliant 2006 book called Female Chauvinist Pigs by Ariel Levy, where she talks about, I don't think this would happen so much more, but women who sort of, you know, for instance, might go out to a strip club with their male colleagues after work because that's where you go to get ahead. And
would that once have worked in newspapers? Seriously?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was a time, not very long ago, when it was a massively macho environment in the newspaper world. I mean,
I was usually the only person in the only woman in the room. I was third ever female political editor of a national newspaper. The second one was called Julia as well, and I used to go to Downing Street briefings, and occasionally a woman would come in the room who wasn't me, who would bring tea for Alistair Campbell. But that was the only time there was ever another woman in the world. Yes,
I went to an award ceremony 2 weeks to do at journalism, and I was the only young woman in the room since 2015. So it hasn't really changed that much.
Abby, you must be used to a lot of male-dominated rooms.
Well, you know what? No.
No?
Because I find my women. I was going to answer your point. I think there are two things. I mean, I've been thinking, Jennifer Lawrence talked about being charming, and I thought, God, you know, I mean, I think we all, what does charming mean? It means getting along, it means, you know, but there are probably times where I've had to be charming. But one of the things I think, one of the gaps that, for example, we have in the film industry is that, particularly with young directors, is they can get their first film made, and it does well in a film award, and they get the awards, and they get patted on the back, and then they watch their male kind of counterparts get Planet of the Apes. And they don't get any phone calls. And so it's getting your second film for women that's really hard. So one of the things that I've been talking a lot about in terms of mentoring young writers is not necessarily mentoring them at the beginning. It's making a longer commitment and saying, let's keep you going, let's keep on. And I think one of the big issues about feminism is, and it goes back to what Juno was saying, was that, you know, it is about leaning in. It is about not thinking that one person's success, be it that they are fighting a campaign and you feel like it's not articulating your protest or your anger, it doesn't take away from your success or your ability to do that. So I think it is about saying, okay, you know, I'm going to send the elevator down, and I'm going to come with it, and I'm going to make sure you get up to the top floor with me. So a lot of it is being very active in that way. So for me, it's about, you know, I'm mentoring a young writer at the moment. I've read a really good script. I think it's really worth pursuing. And in a position of power, I can push her a bit forward. And then I need to go back and make sure that she's still going on in another year or another 2 years. So it's about having a longer-term view and a longer-term commitment. So, but I think it's very difficult. I think it's easy for me because I'm a freelancer. And so whenever I did walk into a room full of men and I found that difficult, I just walked out again and went into another room until I found someone who worked for me. And that's how I remember my first job. I wore exactly the same colour clothes as I realised as the wallpaper. Literally, I was the same colour as the wall. And I thought, I cannot stay here because I can't. I don't know how to get noticed in this room. So I just walked out of the room and I went into another. And I think that's the thing, is that you just have to keep coming out of the room, go into another, and eventually you will find that person. And then you also need to hold on tight and say, walk with me. I need you to walk with me. And I think women need to...
Not having a problem with being in a room that happens to be all men in the same way. We don't want men.
Yeah,
no, I'm saying you
do. I didn't say going into a room full of women. I said, go into another room.
I'm not saying
I could be some of the greatest feminists I've known in my career have been men.
Yeah.
So nobody's saying that, and I'm not saying that to make men feel better. I'm just saying it's a fact. But it's just about us. I think it's about, really is about supporting each other and keeping going forward. I mean, those are just platitudes. I'm going into platitude land, so I'm not going to say any more.
But I also think, and this is not at all to detract from your experience, I do think that there is this thing where we talk about women not helping other women and female bosses as not being, female bosses aren't nice and they don't. It's bull.
Yeah, absolutely.
It really
absolutely.
Is.
What's bull?
This idea that women
don't
help tough
them.
Women at the top don't help other women at the top. It's
I think
bullshit peddled by
don't.
People.
No, I don't think all of them do.
No, no, I'm not saying all of them do. I'm just saying
that there is. I'm talking about the middle.
Yeah, but generally there. I think this idea that women, there's these women that succeed who don't help women. There are some, but I think there is. It has become there is this certain myth, the queen bee syndrome, which I think is vastly inflated and not true.
Absolutely.
Everybody who has helped me along my, this is only my story, so it's not, but everybody who's helped me along my career has, it's been women, it's been fantastic women, one after another after another. And what I see and what I'm, and my fantastic job, I've got the best job in the world, is I get to work with amazing women. I get to work with straight women, I get to work with gay women, I'm working with black women, I'm working with disabled women, I'm working with women, and we're all helping each other and we're all talking to each other and we're all calling each other out when we get it wrong. And I think women work together phenomenally well, and I think we've got to keep fighting back against this idea that women squabble.
And as a model for the world, that's fantastic, and that's why it's called the Women's Equality Party. But if you go across offices up and down the country, you will not find that in the same way.
No, of course not. And no, I've spent 20 years in male offices. I'm just saying, I think we've just got to be a little bit careful about saying that women don't.
Can we all apply to The Apprentice and show them how to do it?
Yeah, that would be good.
Those first opening episodes of The Apprentice my head in.
I think they do everybody's head in. But I think The Apprentice may not be for much longer, delighting us for all that much longer.
Is that an inside story?
No. The hand up at the back, yes. Can we just get the microphones coming? Yeah, it's coming. Thank you.
How was the panel for this evening picked? And do you think that we can have an effective conversation about feminism and gender equality when we're only represented by A, females, and B, I don't necessarily wish to make assumptions, but ostensibly no queer or transgender voices.
On the panel?
On the panel, okay. Yes.
Right. Well, I didn't set up the panel. Or I did.
Was it just the people who said yes?
And it's Thursday's a busy night for a lot of people. That's not a very helpful answer. I don't actually know what the answer to the question is. Nimco, I'm going to throw that one at you. Because you can answer anything in my experience.
Starting with vagina. I think the panel is very diverse, and I think, yes, I do take the fact that it would be interesting to have somebody from different platforms speaking with us, six of us. I was asked because of the campaigning work that I've done, and also for the fact that my kind of main issue is that I'm really concerned about young people and the state of them entering feminism and the fact that we shouldn't make it fun. And I remember when I first met when you're writing your book, and we used to be called the fun feminists because we used to walk around with our fanny quilts and our cunt cakes and talking about real issues like FGM. And I think so my thing is the fact that I was asked because I've done a lot of campaigning work, and also I really want to talk about the state of affairs for young women, especially around issues around sexual harassment and things like that. So that's how I've come on that.
Can I come in on that? It's really hard to make sure that these things are as representative. But I think actually going back to what Abby was saying about suffragette and how obviously I saw the criticism online and how people were saying, it hasn't got this, hasn't got that. I think what's really important is that, especially this came with Lena Dunham's Girls and all of that, I think actually
we should have a space where, you know, there can be more than one suffragette. There doesn't have to be one suffragette film, you know. There doesn't have to be one film that looks at what it's like to be a woman. I know this is not directly linked to what you're trying to say, but I think the broader point I'm trying to make is, like, it doesn't have to be... I don't really think I can represent all young black women out there. I can't. And neither can Nimco, neither can Abby, or, like, represent all different women. I think what actually needs to happen is that we need to reach a stage where we don't expect women to come out and say something and be representative of all women, or a panel to be representative of all views. And I'm not trying to say that that makes it okay that you don't have queer women on a panel or transgender women on a panel, but I do think what needs to happen is that we need to realise that, you know, like, I can come out and write a book about something, and another woman can come out and she can write something else, and another woman can come out. And I think that's what we need to have. We need to stop trying to be like, and it's not completely related, but it is a broader point that actually we do need to reach a point where we don't expect one woman to be, you know, the woman to represent all women. And we do need to have facilitate that space.
Thank you, Jude. Let's just get on a couple of other questions. We've got to finish at 10, so let's just get in a few more comments and questions.
Is this on? Yeah.
Yeah.
My question was for Julia. Just listening to the things that you were saying, and partly it started when you were talking about choice, and then you said you weren't talking about women who were affected by domestic violence. You said that austerity wasn't a feminist issue. You said you're not talking about women in Saudi Arabia when talking about choice. And I just hear a lot of the women that you're not representing, and also you said...
I don't represent anyone.
Right, well, my question will come, but also you said when talking about what was happening in South Africa, if you replace women with black, as a black woman, I'm not able to do that, because if I see black, I also see the fact that I am a woman. It's, you know, that intersection. So my question to you is, I've heard a lot of about the women that you're not speaking about, especially when it came about choice. So who does your feminism represent, and who are you talking about, and who do you think about when you're talking about women have choice, or women are able to do this? Because you've named a lot of women that are excluded from that definition.
Well, I think the conversation we were having was about feminism largely here in Britain, in that context where I said that. I don't assume that a woman who is without a vote and living a subjugated life in Saudi Arabia has choice. That would be absurd. I don't represent anyone, and I've got to be honest with you, when you say who am I talking about when I talk about feminism, I'm surprised as anyone else that I was invited to this panel, because I don't actually spend many hours of any day thinking about feminism. I just do my job, I live my life, I mother my child, and I do the laundry occasionally.
So you do it?
Okay.
But
if I don't feel like doing it, I don't do it.
But you have that privilege.
No,
and other women don't.
Privilege.
That's a fact.
I don't personally consider doing my own laundry a major cause of massive infringement on my freedoms as a woman. Personally, I've got over that. Look, the thing is, I don't feel I represent anyone. I don't think that anyone up here represents anyone, whether they were black, white, middle class, working class, young, old, anything. We've got to stop seeing women in that way. And there was a lot of lovely words spoken, particularly by June, and very inspiring. But I personally find it, a lot of it, unfortunately, doesn't actually, in the realm in which I live, work out to be true, because actually women are shut down for uttering any alternative viewpoint. You have to accept that, almost that horrible phrase, the sisterhood's point of view, or you're not a feminist, you're not one of us, as opposed to treating women as individuals. And I think it's extraordinary that a lot of the modern feminist movement, as it's perceived, such as it exists even, seems to me to actually do exactly what we were fighting against, what my mother fought against and what the suffragettes fought against, was for women to be seen as this sort of... There's men, individual man, and then there's these women, these creatures over here. We're not over here. We're in the middle, and we're all individuals. And I don't share the same opinions as anybody unless we happen to share the same opinions. And certainly not because we happen to have the same colour hair.
I promise I'll get back to everybody on the panel, but let's get some more questions in before we have to finish. So the microphone can come up to the hand up right in the middle, right in front of me now, yes.
Hiya. So my first question, very small question, is how do we know that no one on the panel is gay? I think that's quite a strange assumption to make.
She did say that.
We don't know if anyone was
she
queer.
She said yes.
Yeah. Secondly, so June asked for some support on the issue about girls going into STEM. I'm co-founder of STEMETS, and we're inspiring the next generation of girls to pursue careers in science, technology, engineering, and maths. You know, back to the point on choice, we have girls who are in sick form being told not to study physics because it's not really a girl's subject. We have women at work being called a cunt and being forced to leave, basically, because who wants to be in an environment where they're called that? We have women... again at work, so it's kind of all ages, who are told that they shouldn't let their hair down because it's too girly in a tech company. So I take your point that it is about choice, but they're kind of being forced to choose an option that actually allows them kind of an environment where they can be happy, and that automatically rules out some of the areas where we do need more gender equality, like STEM. So I wonder if you think that's still a choice that women have the privilege to make in those circumstances.
I'm sure other people want to answer, but I think we were talking about choice about doing housework and childcare at the time. But personally, yeah, I think some choices are harder than others. And I think when my mother went to medical school with two young children as a single mum in the 1970s, that was a really, really hard choice. And some choices are harder than others. But those we're going to have to go through that. In the same way, again, I think it's very hard now for a man to go into being a nurse or a carer of young children or a primary school teacher.
So let's make it easier for both sides. Everybody's got to get a thicker skin.
No, I'm not saying I've never uttered those words at all.
But that's essentially what you're saying. You're doing the equivalent of
I'm saying some choices are harder than others.
The hand up there.
But they just are.
Quickly, because we've got to finish in about 2 minutes. The woman's hour drama is about to start, God help us. Come on.
Hi. I have a question for Julia.
Oh, are you sure someone else doesn't want to answer a question?
I just wondered if you think that men and women are judged by the same standards.
No. Oh.
And in that context, how can you talk about free choice?
Yeah. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. I remember very vividly a conversation with my editor when I was in the Sunday newspaper that my mother used to get inside the Observer because she was so ashamed of me for working for it. And I remember him. I was very angry. He'd had a conversation with my deputy that totally undermined something that I'd already arranged to do. My deputy being a man, and I went into his office and went completely ballistic on him. And he said, "I'm really sorry you're upset." And I said, "Upset? You think this is my upset face?" No, when I'm crying, I'm upset. This is my fucked off face. Learn the difference. He would never have said to a man, "Are you upset?" Women, of course, get called bolshy, get called hysterical, all of that. Of course, women are judged. They're judged on what they wear. Interesting fact about Angela Merkel. Did you know she carries it? Everywhere she goes, she takes a stylist and a hairdresser. A woman who's never talked about for her appearance has a stylist and a hairdresser. And the reason she does that is that she always looks exactly the same. She wears exactly the same clothes and exactly the same style with the same haircut, so no one ever discusses it. So she's fought against that, and it's one way of doing it. We are judged differently. I'm not saying it's fair. I'm hoping it will change, and it's something that I think has changed massively over the years. But that doesn't mean we don't have free choice.
The choices that you make.
It affects choices, but we still have choices. Sometimes we choose the harder choice.
Okay. I don't think that in a patriarchal society with misogyny and sexism and things like capitalism that there is such thing as a free choice, and that's something I really, really stand by. Okay. That you might make choices, but I don't think they're always free.
No,
I think we need to address that in feminism.
Let's just really briefly go around the panelists who haven't had the chance to speak just very recently. So, Abby.
Oh, I've talked so much.
Have you?
Honestly,
okay, Nimco. Round it off. Right, your personal. What's your take on what you've heard tonight?
It's really interesting. I'm always very uncomfortable with the word choice because it's such a loaded word, and we kind of like, you know, project it onto people, and I don't think there's free choice. I think we need to be conscious of our own privileges every time we say people choose to do things.
Exactly.
And that comes into a lot of issues around violence against women and girls in daily lives. So I think choice is a very kind of tainted word.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Sophie.
I spent this afternoon at a refuge for women who are experiencing domestic violence because today is Human Rights Day, as you know, and it's the end of our 16 days of action against to try to prevent violence against women and girls. And what really struck me, apart from it sounds terribly cheesy, but really the bravery of the women who were telling me their stories, was how structurally sexist the society in which they is, in which they were trying to escape the situation in which they found themselves. You know, the onus was, it was, they told me that everything told them, from the police to the social workers to the justice courts, that it was their fault. That it was their fault for getting beaten up, it was their fault for not being able to get out, or it was their fault for then leaving and their kids had to be taken away from them because they ran. And I just, you know, I find this whole discussion about, you know, women have choices, or you just just, you know, you've got to try harder. And I think actually what we've got to dismantle the structures. Yeah. And stop, and you know, we've really just got to take it all apart. Yeah.
And Kira, briefly.
Yeah. I really liked Abby's point earlier about it being a kind of constant and ongoing discourse. And what I would love to do sort of after this is to get out there and make something. You know, the suffragettes got out there and they made a campaign where some of them were force-fed, you know, 242 times. Well, no, that's what it's exciting, though. You know, you've got up there and you've made something. All of you have made things, and that's really exciting. You know, you can have people being force-fed. You know, in the 70s, the kind of number of women's organisations which were set up then, you know, things that we take for granted now, like Rape Crisis and Refuge. You know, in the third wave, in the sort of 90s, you had this incredible kind of round of, like, brilliant sort of punk feminists who just went, yeah, I can't play the fucking guitar. I'm going to start a band today, you know? And actually, you've seen that as well with women today. It's so exciting, you know, when I was interviewing people, and lots of them didn't even see themselves as feminists when they started. So someone like Laura Bates, who started Everyday Sexism, Lucy Ann Holmes, who started the No More Page 3 campaign, they didn't even call themselves feminists before they started those campaigns. They just saw a problem. And they got out there and they made something. And so it's been great having this conversation, but I suppose for me personally, I'm excited about the people who are making things. So I hope that's right. You know, Kat Viner, who's taken over The Guardian, like people making things and really making a massive difference.
Okay. That's a really, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No,
I do think that's a really positive, engaging way to end. So Kira, thank you. And thanks to everybody on the panel and to you as well for coming tonight. Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.